Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
You are in luck. Owl Post for the week is freshly delivered in. I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is always, the ever-vescent Drea Kaufman.
Hello!
Howdy!
How are ya?
You know what? Doing good. I always like it when we get to the end of a book. You know, reading them this way is a little bit different because obviously, you know, I could just read forward, but I don't. So I have to
wait. Oh, it's so hard not to at this point.
Yeah. And so last week especially was kind of hard not to get to this chapter that we're at here, which is Veritaserum, as we get the answers to exactly what's been going on and why it's been going on, because we're going to catch the bad guy. And so it was nice to finally get there. And gosh, I can't believe that in 2 weeks we'll be finished with this book, and then we'll be diving into
Order of the Phoenix.
That's just crazy. It's just crazy.
I know.
Oh, man.
I'm also really proud of myself because this is where my books all mash together between Order of the Phoenix and Half-Blood Prince. I'm always like, one comes and then the other. Like, so I'm always like, oh, that's right. Harry isn't crazy angry yet. So it's Order of the Phoenix.
Yep. Well, and, you know, there's... You know, this is a very large book, and it really opens up the entire world in many ways, and she just kind of blows open the gates and what it means to be, you know, in the Harry Potter universe. And so, yeah, this one's been really fun to talk through, and now I'm just really excited to dive into those later books because, you know, all the things that happen to them are so cool. But anyway, we'll get there. Just hold your horses, hold your thestrals. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. But if you're searching for podcasts, you know, did you know, Drea, we're actually on Spotify now?
Nice.
Yeah.
I did not.
Yeah. So all of the shows here on the network, I believe, are actually on Spotify, which is fantastic. So, you know, you can search for Owl Post there. You can search for us in iTunes. You can search for us Apple Podcasts, Spreaker. We're on so many different platforms. So you can check us out. But honestly, one of the most important things you can do to help Owl Post continue to grow is if you are an Apple Podcast or iTunes, give us a star rating review. It really does help the show grow. That is still the place where a majority of podcast listeners get their podcasts. And so really does help us out. But heck, you know, give us reviews wherever you are listening so that people will find us. Also, just make sure you subscribe too, because that means that every time I drop a show, like when I get it set up, the moment it comes out is the moment that it will download to you. So do that. Also, follow us all over the place. You can find us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/nerdparty. We've got the nerdparty.com. And if that is not enough places to contact us, Drea and I love getting emails. And you can send us an email over on thenerdparty.com/contact. You choose a show, you choose Owl Post, and then Drea and I get that email. We can talk to you that way. So, yes. You know, I really... The beginning of this chapter is one that I like. So, I mean, this whole chapter I like so much better than the movie. I'm just going to put that out there. It's way better done than the movie is.
But no.
Yeah.
Matt likes the book better than the
movie? It's shocking.
Sorry.
It's shocking.
It's like sarcasm.
But I believe that what makes it better, one, is Harry's connection with Dumbledore here at the beginning once he gets back. And I really liked that it's Dumbledore, the one that kind of comes over. And this is where the movie, I think, really did itself a disservice. You know, the movie had Dumbledore immediately being aggressive towards Harry the moment his name is drawn out of the Goblet of Fire. But we notice, if you're reading the book, that slowly and surely, Dumbledore starts to kind of lose his cool a little bit, and this is the chapter where his cool actually is finally lost, because.
Well, I don't think his cool is lost.
He didn't, I don't like, know when he walks into that office and he's defending cool Harry before, Potter. You know.
No, I feel like his cool's not lost. He just is more straight to the point here. Well, at least in the beginning of the chapter. I think you're right. I think at the end of the chapter, he really does start to lose his cool a little bit. And definitely in the next chapter, I think he totally loses his cool. But I think here he just knows that time is of the essence, and it's not about dropping his cool. It's about being, he's much more direct and a little more assertive here. I think you cross over into aggressive later on. After the majority of this chapter happens, when we get into the next chapter, I think he totally loses his cool. But I think that right now he just sort of, this is the moment where in the movie, Michael Gambon as Dumbledore rushes up to Harry and is like, did you put your name in the cup, Harry? You know, like that sort of like assertiveness and that like level of almost franticness comes out here. But I don't know that I would consider it as Dumbledore losing his cool, only because we get it amped up even more later. And so if this is him losing his cool, then what is that?
Well, yeah, I just read it that way because, you know, it says that, you know, he kind of grabs Harry roughly and he turns him over and he's like yelling, Harry and Harry, you know, like you don't really get exclamation points most of the time after Dumbledore says something. But the fact that Dumbledore is more intense at this moment,
yes.
Like it's again, I think the movie did a disservice by having that intensity at that point instead of kind of having it slowly grow, because throughout this book, Dumbledore's intensity has slowly grown. And this chapter, it kind of like, and then, you know, like you said, in the next chapter, it kind of just like, it comes out.
It spirals.
Yeah, it does.
I found this part really interesting because we don't awfully get, so we don't usually get a Dumbledore who sort of loses it or drops the calming demeanor. But we also don't usually get a stern Hagrid either. And he was pretty stern with Mad-Eye, who is eventually who we find out grabbed Harry. And is like, nope, Dumbledore said you should stay, you should stay. Like, he was very firm with him, trying to get him to stay. So I thought that that was also interesting and spoke to kind of the severity of what was happening. Because, you know, we know what happened as readers and as Harry's POV, but, you know, the entirety of the audience and teachers and everyone are still figuring out what's going on. So to have Hagrid even sort of super serious and understanding what's, you know, that this is a serious matter. And I just use the word serious like six times in a row. So yeah, you know, I'm serious, guys. but for him to have that same emphasis is pretty significant. Because usually he's the fun-loving one and tries to make things, you know, lighthearted. No, don't worry about it. I'm going to cover it. You know, like he tries to shelter the kids a little bit more as kids. And this is the first time where he's like, no, at all. And I took that really to heart because that's not a side of Hagrid we see often.
Well, and I mean, this is such a chaotic scene, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The whole thing, you know, the Cornelius Fudge is wanting one thing. Dumbledore is wanting another. And
the Diggories are coming down from the stands.
I mean, people are.
Someone's trying to haul Harry away.
People are crying and sobbing.
Out of it. People are screaming.
Yes.
Like, it's just so chaotic. It's so much more chaotic than it was in the book. In the book, it was much brief and brisk, and no one seemed to kind of know what was going on. So everyone was kind of like, oh, what's going on? But this one is the one where, like, straight up everyone's like, freaking out. Like, like you imagine it would honestly be like.
Well, and I do have to give the movie credit, because the moment where, you know, Amos comes up, you know, and he's crying over his son in the movie, if it doesn't always make you cry, you're probably a heartless person, because that scene is played so well. And the anguish of a father losing a son is so poignant in that moment, and it comes through on screen perfectly. And so that's what's happening here. And then I do love that, you know, Dumbledore and Hagrid have told Harry to stay, and the way she describes it is that his scar is feeling so badly he wants to throw up, and he can barely see because his vision is so blurred because of the pain of his scar. And
his leg, yes. And just the shock that he's going through.
Oh, it's awful.
And to the Amos Diggory point, we don't get as much of him in the movie as we do in the book. Like, we do see a lot more. We talked about the scene where he's kind of taking Rita Skeeter's readings to heart, and then he never kind of takes to Harry, which is different than the movie. But I still think that the actor they cast to do that in the movie did a phenomenal job of making you understand how proud this dad is of his son, because it's super, he lays it on super thick in the book. Yeah. So, I mean, if there's any parent to lose a kid combination, that would just be the biggest blow to your little heartstrings. It was definitely the Diggorys. Like, that. They might even top the Weasleys. Like, the Weasleys love their kids and are proud, but like the Diggorys have that overly proud thing that it's just like, you know, this is their entire life gone now.
And in all of this, somebody basically starts pulling Harry towards the castle, across the lawn, past the lake, and Harry's just, he doesn't really know what's happening. Again, it's part of that is because he's having a really hard time focusing on anything. And he starts getting asked questions about what happened. And he realizes that it's Mad-Eye Moody. And Harry starts kind of telling him what's going on. You know, the cup was a portkey. It took me to Cedric. Voldemort was there. And then he keeps getting questioned about, you know, who was there. How did the Dark Lord came back? You know, what did he do to the Death Eaters? And throughout all of this, you know, he finds it really, he starts to find some of the questioning strange, you know, but, you know, he remembers what Dumbledore had said, that, you know, that Mad-Eye, you know, couldn't stand Death Eaters. The last thing he would want them to do was to escape.
I found it really interesting because I feel like if she was trying to get across that the line of questioning was very strange, I don't know that he responded to it super well. Like, I was paying attention this time because I was curious. No opponent to Voldemort calls him the Dark Lord. So no one actually against him. So that's your first indication in this chapter that Mad-Eye, like the Mad-Eye we know, is not a friend to Harry, because he refers to him as the Dark Lord a couple of times before he comes clean. But I don't think that Harry as a written character responded super well to this like strange line of questioning. Like, I don't think he figured it out like he did kind of in the movie, right, where you can see him put it together. And in this case, we had to have a very expository explanation from the bad guy. It's almost like the Bond villain who like speaks up and is like, let me tell you my evil plan, you know? And I thought that was really interesting. And I actually didn't like it. I mean, it definitely, I think it buttoned up more of the open storylines than the movie did, but I liked the method of delivery better in the movie, where Harry kind of figures it out and then he sort of admits to it because he's figured it out, and because that Polyjuice portion starts wearing off and things like that. But I don't think the delivery of this big epic moment was quite as good for me in the book as it happens more organically in the film.
I think you're wrong. Just teasing. No,
okay.
I mean,
you could think I'm wrong.
No,
I might be wrong.
No, I mean, I do get what you're saying. And I think that the difference here is that there are 20 different mysteries that have been happening that she has to unravel. Whereas, obviously, in the movie,
they cut a lot of
there's
that
like
the movie.
one, which is
there's like maybe two.
Yeah, like who is Moody basically is the question.
Yeah, but when you think about the fact that he then gets put in the Veritas sermon, a lot of that could have been explained in that sense, but instead he decides to offer it up to Harry. Like, there was no reason for that, especially considering it was just like Voldemort. He gets on the soapbox and starts preaching his evilness to him. But
I also think it's because he's doing the same thing that Voldemort did in the you know, graveyard, which is he thinks he has Harry dead to rights and that he's going to escape.
I mean, yes, but this character has not been painted as the super egotistical villain like we have with Voldemort, who, you know, he's just like full of him. Like, part of that diatribe is coming from a place of ego. And I don't know. It didn't work for me. Like, I totally understand what she was intending and where she was going. And I did appreciate getting those storylines wrapped up. I'm just saying that I wish she'd found a way to make it a little more organic. Like, if she'd even added another paragraph or so of giving Harry an opportunity to come to it a little bit more, figure this out, kind of ask some questions like, why are you saying this? What's going on? You know, versus him sort of only coming to after, like right as it's starting to be presented to him. Like, I wish that he had an opportunity to play a role in discovering it versus just being told.
I mean, I guess I see,
but again, I could be wrong, Matt. Tell me I'm wrong.
I see what you're saying. I don't agree because I like it better. The thing that I like about this for me, and part of it is because of the way that J.K. Rowling, you know, explains Barty Crouch Jr. in the book. And at the beginning, we see him almost being more innocent. We almost see him as a character who has maybe been falsely accused. And so,
in the pensive memories,
right? Exactly. Because that's what we really know of him throughout the book. And so here she is unraveling that idea and showing you that not only is Barty Crouch Jr. bad, but he's actually one of the worst of the Death Eaters through this.
So I don't disagree with that, and I don't disagree with that plot element. I disagree with how it was delivered. Like, you still could have had him do that if you let Harry have this moment where he's like, wait a second, this isn't right, and have him be like, oh, okay, you caught me, and then had all of that diatribe come out. I mean, it's especially with the story with the, you know, the background of like him and his dad and like basically living under the Imperius curse for so long. Right. Like, you're also supposed to feel a little bit of sympathy, and you start to wonder a little bit if he really was that bad, or if him being sort of like endlessly tortured by his father made him like turn to Voldemort even more, you know. So I don't even think that was painted super clearly. So if you had made it more obvious that he was still kind of trying to deceive Harry a little bit, and then Harry figures it out and he's like, okay, I'll tell you everything, then I think it would have been better than him sort of boasting it, because I don't have any reason to believe he's got reason to boast. Like, do you know what I mean?
I just didn't feel it. Because I feel like that the character here is put it this way. The book Harry is not as smart as the movie Harry. And this is one of the places where Harry is pretty good at putting puzzle pieces together, right? But again, the character that Harry has known of Mad-Eye Moody has been one who has been pretty helpful to him and pretty kind to him and actually given him good advice throughout the book. And so I think that he is used to people kind of being what they say they are for the most part in this universe for around him a lot of times. You know, I mean, when you think back to like the first book, you know, it's not like him and Quirrell were close ever, you know, and those kind of things. And so it's just, I feel like this is his learning moment. This is Harry's learning moment of like, people aren't always what they look like they are. They aren't always. And so to me, that's,
well, but she teased us a little bit, right? She started dropping these hints for the reader to figure out. But then let's forget about Harry for a second. Let's just talk about us as readers. She gave us these hints to sort of put together the puzzle that Mad-Eye was not on our side, but didn't give us quite long enough to come to that conclusion. It's like she was afraid we weren't going to get there, so she just told us really quick. So, you know, she starts by dropping the Dark Lord thing. She starts with, you know, Harry being like, oh yeah, I forgot to say there's a Death Eater here. Who do you think it is? Karkaroff. And then he just tells you, right? Like, you don't have any time to sort of put together the fact, okay, so if it's not Karkaroff, who is it? Like, you literally don't even have an entire sentence to do that, because he immediately fesses up to the fact that it was him and that he's the Death Eater. And it's like, all right, well, I was going to figure it out, and now I don't have the opportunity. So forget about Harry. Just talk about us as readers. Like, in the movie, us as viewers have the opportunity to watch Harry put that together for us. We don't have that opportunity in the book, which to me was a little bit of a letdown, because as someone who really enjoys like the mystery and puzzle part of things, I didn't have enough opportunity before this chapter to put that together. And now I didn't get to in the chapter because you just told me what's happening. So for me, I was let down by that, and I wish she had extended it even half a page and given me a few sentences like, oh, as Harry lets this soak in, and then I let it soak in too. You know, I just wish it wasn't so quick to share that with me. And I think this is just one of those times where you and I kind of will always disagree, and it's happened in films before where I feel like something's too expository and you thought it was fantastic. So I just think this is that crux in the book where we're just going to disagree on that. And I don't think one way is right over the other. I think it just depends on your preference. But for me, I would have liked another few sentences or a paragraph or two to figure it out for myself and be able to be like, haha, I did it, guys, and have like my Scooby-Doo moment. And she took that from me.
So the things that I feel like ended up working for me in it were the way that we get Crouch telling the story so that we see why it is that he does what he does, and it's because he thinks he's going to be the best Death Eater there is, and what he wants, and he even says it later, I'll be his best follower, I'll be his brother, like, because he sees this connection between him and Voldemort, the way that they've grown up, the way that they both had fathers that were disappointing to them, and they feel like, you know, felt like held them back and were just, you know, wastes of space, basically. And what he wants, I feel like, is he basically wants to have connection. And what he's looking for is connection with Voldemort that Voldemort's never going to be able to give anybody, you know, like Voldemort doesn't care about, you know, this kind of connection, but this is what Crouch wants. I think that's fascinating. He's basically looking for love in all the wrong places. You know, you're not going to get Voldemort being your best bud and your brother. He will look at you well as a follower, but you're still going to be a follower. There's never going to be anything more to that. And that's what I thought was really interesting by him talking about all of these things with Harry. And part of it is just, I think there is a pride goeth before the fall kind of thing going on here, which is, allow me to show you how much smarter I've been than everybody else this year. And I feel like Crouch, because he spent so much time underneath the Imperius curse and everything like that, and he feels at this moment that he's won, because he's going to kill Harry and then he's going to go back to the Dark Lord and he's going to be the greatest Death Eater ever. There is this moment where it's like he wants to crow, you know, about how great he is. And it's that monologuing, which always kills villains, you know. It's that, it is very cliched. I'm going to monologue, and I'm not going to be able to escape because I'm going to monologue too long, and I'm going to forget to do what I actually should have done, which is I should have just killed Harry and left, you know.
I took his little, I agree, he was looking for that camaraderie, if you will, that like shared sense of pain.
Yeah.
But I almost felt like, you have this rich little wizard boy who is rebelling against daddy and reaches out and gets caught up in the wrong crowd, and then would do anything to gain the acceptance of that crowd. And so I like that he was willing to do whatever, and he was really clever in how he did things and how it worked out. And yes, I totally agree. Like, he was looking for that love in all the wrong places from Voldemort. Like, he was never going to get his approval ever. He was obviously too needy, which is just shown in his need to have this huge, like, diatribe soapbox, right? Like, if you know Lord Voldemort, you know, he is the only one with a soapbox ever. And, like, you just sit there and fawn over him on his soapbox and that's it, right? Like, that's all you're allowed to do. And so I just found it so almost pathetic in that, like, as he's sharing all this, like, I almost felt sorry for him. Like, oh, poor little rich wizard boy. Like, yeah, that sucks that your daddy, like, kept you under the Imperius curse and that blows, and that your mommy died and, like, all this stuff. But I don't know. I just felt like, I don't know. He was very clever in what he did and in his service, but I never really believed in his cause. Like, I didn't believe he was doing it because he thought, like, there was no indication that he was involved in this because he truly believed the cause of what was happening. I think he just wanted the acceptance and wherever he could get it. And he wasn't getting it where he was because his daddy was kind of a jerk. And so, you know, he decided, I'm going to join the wolf pack or the whatever, the Death Eater pack, and and do that because that's what all the cool people are doing. And they'll accept me and we'll have our own secret code. Like, it just felt very much like that. And so as he's going on in his story, I'm like, oh, world's tiniest violin, you know, like,
you want some cheese with that wine?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
I do feel like that is very much there. And one of the things that you get with all of that as well is you do see this character who, because of that, he's willing to do whatever it takes to get that, you know, and the fact that, the sickness of okay, this is where, like, Barty Crouch Sr.
is a total jerk.
Yeah, like,
his
wife and him, like, they switch places, and she's the one who ends up dying in Azkaban because she's been taking Polyjuice Potion to be him, and, like, why would you do that? Like,
it tells me that how I read it is that Barty Crouch and Barty Crouch Jr. were never close ever, and that the mother was that sort of tying thread together, and that mom asked as sort of her last dying wish that dad take pity on son. Right. And so dad saves son, but has to figure out a way to do it, and that he doesn't let anyone know that he did it. So instead of being like, I'm a proud father and I'm just going to keep you hidden and I'm going to protect you, it's like, I'm going to keep you cursed and in the house because I told your mom I would do it, but I never said how I would do it. And I can't have you getting out or thinking independently because I don't trust you. And so I'm going to keep you under my thumb the entire time, watched by my house elf. Right. Mm-hmm. So I just took it as, like, this cruel father who never really felt connected to his son, and that it was kind of always mom. Like, mom was the one. Because if you remember, I think in the Pensieve chapter, something about his mom and breaking her heart or something came up. So, I mean, I always took this as, like, his dad just never really cared about him, like, at all. And he was doing this because his wife asked him to. Like, that was it.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that that they did, that there was, it was the mother, and she's the one who had made the decision. And because she was dying, she made, you know, Barty Crouch Sr. do this for Junior. And it is just, I don't know, it seems like...
just cruel.
Yeah, it's cruel, and honestly, if I had been Senior, I would have been like, no, I'm not getting our son out of prison for what he did so that you can die in prison. No, not, you know, like, but he doesn't even have the cojones to stand up to his wife in that way to say, no, that's not right. You know, like, it's just, this whole thing is such a mess. And then that's where, of course, we get the whole story with where Winky comes in and how all of this fits together. And we've kind of hopped a little bit around. But
yeah, sorry.
No. I mean, it's okay. I mean, it, you know, everybody's either I've just read the chapter, so it's not like we're screwing around with anything. But, you know, I also think it is interesting when he is boasting to just Harry. The cleverness of Junior to find a way around all of these powerful wizards like Dumbledore and Snape and all of these other wizards, you know, when he's telling him story, it is actually kind of incredible that he's able to do what he is able to do. And he does it relatively well for the most part, because there isn't anybody that has seemed to suspect him, you know, that he can tell. So it is pretty impressive when you
no one's quite figured it out.
Yeah.
I feel like Dumbledore had his suspicions.
Yes. Yeah.
But had no explanation or understanding on how it was happening. Yeah, I thought it was really clever. I thought it was interesting that we go all the way back to chapter like one or two with the Quidditch World Cup and understanding why Winky held an empty mm-hmm. seat now, because it really wasn't empty. You know, and that's how Harry's wand set off the signal and all of that. I did like all of those elements. And I did find that really interesting. I don't know what he expected to happen if he had killed Harry. Like, I don't know how he expected to escape and rejoin Lord Voldemort. And I did feel like there was a lot of help from Voldemort and Wormtail in this case as to accomplishing this. Like, we hear that Mad-Eye was captured that night of the dustbin incident, and it's, you know, that was the first time that he actually portrayed Mad-Eye. But I think my favorite element of the charade was actually the fact that he got away with drinking the polyjuice potion out of the hip flask, because Moody really only did ever drink out of the hip flask because of his paranoia of his drink getting spiked or being poisoned or whatever. I thought that was just amazing, because it speaks to that paranoia, you know, like that innate paranoia. You can never 100% protect yourself. In this case, it actually was part of his undoing, and that no one figured it out for so long. So I thought that was probably my favorite little element of this, of the whole charade of what was happening.
I really also enjoyed the fact that one of the reasons that this unravels is because Wormtail doesn't do his job, and that things begin to unravel when, you know, Senior has escaped. And that's because Wormtail was supposed to be keeping an eye on him at the residence of the Crouches, and he doesn't do the job he's supposed to. So, you know, it's interesting how, you know, we've been talking about every once in a while the idea that the bad guys lose in the end because of something they end up doing that screws things up. And, you know, we see that it unravels here because some of the bad guys involved in the plot don't do what they're supposed to do, and things get out of hand. And they're, you know, as good as Junior had been at, you know, fooling people, there was only so much he could do. And like you said, Dumbledore did seem to have some suspicions. He too is having trouble until this point of putting all the pieces together. But I have to say, probably my favorite moment is when the door blasts apart, Moody is thrown on the floor, and Dumbledore is standing there with Snape and McGonagall at his side. He's got his posse. And there's that moment where she says that why Dumbledore is the only wizard Voldemort ever feared, and it's because of the look on his face, and that he is just, in this moment, he is radiating power, as if he was, like, she describes it as if he was giving off burning heat. So there's this, this, it's almost like this moment with Dumbledore. And again, it's not done very well in the movie at all. In fact, you never get that feeling in the movie. But this is one of those places where it's like, it's that cold fire in his eyes, you know, and this is, I think, the first moment where we really get a sense of the power of the man And hint, hint, the next book will give us even more of a look at that, which I can't wait for because it's awesome. So, you know.
I really like even the lead up to that, and that we were talking about bad guys are kind of their own undoing, and then this idea that ego is going to take them down, right? We start with him just sharing all this information, taking all this time to explain everything. But then we also get the fact that he stops watching his sticks, if you will. He stops watching his back. He focuses all his attention on Harry, and Harry's able to see that Snape, McGonagall, and he's able to see three wizards are coming, three figures are coming. And then it turns out to be, you know, the cavalry. But he's able to see this coming, and, you know, Barty Crouch Jr. never notices because he stopped paying attention to his surroundings and the sneakoscope and using his magical eye and all of that. So I thought that was also a really interesting element, and it feeds into that same idea that bad guys are their own undoing. So I like that little touch too, because she brought it to your attention to it one or two times that, like, he's still not looking. Nope, still fixated on me. All right. Whatever you say, man. You know, and for all Harry knew, it could have been the bad guys coming. So he didn't really know what to expect. But, you know, then you have the moment where he blows down the door and Dumbledore comes swooping in. And I did like to, I think my other favorite part is when Dumbledore gives direction to McGonagall and Snape.
Yeah.
And they're the weirdest sounding instructions ever. And Harry's like, well, they did, if they thought it was strange, they never let on, you know. And Harry's like, I don't know what's happening. This is all super weird, you know, like, get a vial from your office and go fetch a dog from a pumpkin patch. Okay.
Yeah, that seems
let's do that.
Quite odd. Indeed.
That seems important.
Yeah.
So. And when you hear a dog outside Hagrid's, you think Fang. So, and it's not Fang.
Not Fang.
Not Fang at all.
You know, one of the things that I really appreciate here, too, is that, again, I think this is the place where the book is better than the movie, because this really was a very intricate story. Yes. There were a lot of moving parts. And the movie dumbs this down so far that it doesn't actually really make a lot of sense for the most part.
Well, it leaves a lot of plot holes unfilled
that
you don't realize are unfilled until you, like, take a step back and start thinking about them and go, but wait, how did this happen? When did this happen? When did Moody get swapped out? How did that happen? You know, all of that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we finally understand all of these things about, you know, Bertha Jorkins and how Winky fits into everything. We understand how, you know, even characters like Dobby fit in. And I mean, there's just so many things that have been happening throughout this book that weave into the story here. And this chapter finally does explain all of those things. And, you know, I appreciate her attention to detail. And it is interesting, you know, I do feel like there are these little hints throughout the entire book that this is where it's going to go. And, you know, I would be really interested to know if anybody, you know, who maybe was just reading this had called it, because I don't know. For the most part, I feel like this one is a little bit too intricate to be like have called everything that was going to happen in this explanation.
I don't think that throughout the book she gave you quite enough hints to put all the puzzle pieces together. You probably had some idea. You'd figured out there was a Death Eater before you were told. You had figured out that likely it was the coming of Voldemort, if you knew anything about the book series. You know, I think you could put some pieces together, but I don't think you'd see, like, the port key coming, or the Triwizard Cup becoming a port key, or Cedric dying so unspectacularly, or the fact that Barty Crouch Jr. was the bad guy, and that he's Mad-Eye Moody, and that we've never actually met Mad-Eye Moody yet. I think the few of those elements you couldn't put together until you got to this chapter. I don't think you could most definitely put together the Crouch story until this chapter. Like, there's no way you could have figured any of that out. But I think there are some elements you could have come to, but I think putting the whole puzzle together would have been very difficult. But yeah, I would love to know what people were able to discern on their first read through before they got to this chapter. Especially because only last chapter we found out that there's a Death Eater for sure at Hogwarts. I think it was very intricate. And I think that's part of why they cut so much out for the movie is because that would have been incredibly difficult to portray. But I think there was a balance. They cut too much out for the movie and she put too much in the book. But again, everything she wrote had a purpose and a place and an intention, and nothing kind of goes unused or addressed. There was nothing superfluous in her writings or her book. It was just a very, very intricate web that she wove, which is why I think she backed herself into a corner and had to give you this expository explanation of what's going on, because I don't think you could have inferred much of this closing.
And that's kind of her style. I mean, I've read all of her mystery books as well. And honestly, that's kind of what she does. That is definitely the J.K. Rowling style, which is to...
That's the Rowling way.
Yeah, the Rowling way. It's not to be confused with Rowling Rock, which is, you know, a decent beer. So,
Or the Johnny Karate way. Exactly. Also not confused with that.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. I think that one of the things that she's kind of known for is setting up the mystery and then explaining the whole mystery to you at the end. You know, this one, I think this is the first time where it's so big. I mean, even when I think back to the third book, which, you know, has a pretty decent explanation in it, this one is just the biggest one she's tried to do yet. And obviously this is the second longest book in the series, but of course, you know, at that point when it came out, it was the longest by a long shot. So, you know, we really do see that Rowling had really spread her wings as an author here and really tried to do something that she hadn't before. And so, you know, I think throughout the entire series, honestly, I think there's some kind of, there are a few growing pains, you know, and I think maybe that's why for you, some things here don't work quite as well as they do for me, and that's part of that. So that's kind of what happens, I guess, when you're really working. I mean, when we're really doing something that you've never done before. So I think this chapter, you know, again, it leads me wanting to go right into the next chapter, because where we end up in it is that Crouch, you know, is still pretty proud of himself, even though he's on Veronity Serum, about the fact that he had offered to carry the Triwizard Cup and, to the middle of the maze, and that he had turned it into his port key, and that his master's plan went off basically without a hitch tonight. You know, he might not live.
Except that Cedric came with them, and even then it's a minor hitch.
Yeah, which... And you know, I think that's something that's actually pretty important too. And it's one of the things that I appreciate about what she did here as well, is that she shows their complete and utter disregard for life. You know, Barty Crouch Jr., his mother dies, he kills his own father. You know, they tortured and he helps torture and kill Bertha Jorkins, basically. So, I mean, all of this, I think we see a clear picture of the evil in which Harry Potter is facing, and he's got to see it face to face. And it's going to make sense, I think, that there is going to be a bit of a struggle for him next book. And one of the reasons I think he's going to be so angry when you come face to face with evil like this, I think... there's a sense of powerlessness that can kind of come from that when you see it and not sure how to defeat it. And, you know, I think that's going to drive Harry crazy a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's that feeling of injustice because people are willing to stoop to some level, or do things that are you wouldn't be willing to do. And the idea of how do you fight something like that when you're not willing to go to that extent and no one's playing by the rules? Like, how are you supposed to be able to win? So I think it's gonna be a theme that definitely expands. And the next chapter is gonna sort of lead us into expectations for the next couple of books. So I'm excited to move on and finish off this book, because I think we have what, like, two chapters left.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
I know, maybe three. There's about three major things that happen here. So it'll be interesting to see what happens as we wrap up this particular storyline and move on to what happens now that Lord Voldemort's back, and you know, how that's received and how we handle it from here on out, and the interesting journey that Harry gets to take now. So I'm really excited. And I think a lot of that starts even as soon as the next chapter. So, yeah, so there's so much that happens, including Harry sharing his part of the story and so on and so forth. So I'm excited to move on and see what happens next and where we go from here. Now that Barty Crouch Jr. Is kind of in the picture, if you will. Also, he'll always be the doctor to me. So it's really hard to watch him as the Peter. That's all, and I got to say, man.
I mean, you know, he does play a great villain.
David
Tennant is so good. I mean, obviously, he's the same way in Jessica Jones. So he really can dig in and play somebody that freaks you the heck out. So
I think he's also a villain in the American Gods series this next season.
Yeah.
Yeah, him and one of the other British actors are both, or British comedians, are the angel and the devil in that series. So he also plays a bad guy there. Apparently that's just where he gets his jollies.
Apparently. Wow. So, Drea, if anybody wants to catch up with you and see what maybe you love besides David Tennant, or maybe just a lot of David Tennant, where can people find you?
Now I get to load my Instagram up with David Tennant. Thank you.
Yes.
if you want to come check me out, you can find me on Twitter at PCFChick, or, like I mentioned, Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And I am at Twitter and on the Twitter as well. Matt Rushing 02, Instagram under the same name. I am here on the network doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, talking about Star Wars each and every week. Just a fun new topic each week that something that we're thinking about within the saga. You can find me over on the Trek FM network doing The Orb with Chris Jones about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. So do the General Geek Show over there, the 602 Club, talking about all things we love in all fandoms, as many fandoms as we possibly can get in there. You know, there's good Harry Potter talk over there, so check it out. You can also find me doing a show called Cinema Stories, and that is where I am talking about films through the lens of faith with my friend Courtney. But thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.